My name is Jacob. I'm from 2008. where I did the program, and I'm currently the chairman of the Danish Senior Fellow Association, and I'll be your host the rest of the evening. The next speaker we have is has been a member of the Dutch Parliament since 1998 and has been the Minister of European Affairs the last 4 years. I just had the pleasure of meeting him. He's very inspirational, and I wish we had Danish politicians that talk like that. He's here to talk about European identities and give some perspectives on that. We're going to do it. He's going to talk for about 15 minutes, and then we're going to open up for a Q&A. So please welcome Frans Timmermans.
Thank you very much. The problem now is that what is expected of me is a coherent speech, but after this afternoon, I have a bit of a problem being coherent, but I'll do my best. What I want to talk to you about is identity, and I want to start by telling you something about the result of the Dutch election, which was very recently held for our parliament, which has been a surprise to many people because they had the biggest result, the best result, not the biggest party, but the best increase of numbers of votes, was for a party that could be considered xenophobic, anti-Islam, and has a speech which does not provide much hope, at least not from my perspective. And the interesting thing is that in my constituency, if I can call it that, I'm from the south of this country, that party got 1 out of 4, sometimes even 1 out of 3 votes. And what I did since the election, which was held on the 9th of June, is take my bike, because I love to ride my bike, so I had an excuse, take my bike and go to all sorts of places and meet people and just ask them, why? Just tell me. And I've done a similar thing in 2002 when Pim Fortuyn got this election result, after his death even. And people then were very aggressive. It was very difficult for a Social Democrat to have that conversation with people. They aren't aggressive now. But then two main answers came out of my deliberations with all these people. The first was, you guys aren't listening. We want you guys to listen. And so we've just given you a slap in the face by voting for that party. So please listen. And the second element was, this country is in total shambles. We are the third world. It's better to be living in, I don't know where, in Chad than here. Now, the first issue, the first answer, gives me cause for hope. Because if people say you don't listen, apparently they want you to listen, apparently they still have a basis for debate or trust, because otherwise they wouldn't even bother. That is hopeful. But then, for political parties who want to be seen, and politicians who want to be seen as listening, the second issue is a very, very difficult challenge. Because if you say, hang on a bit, we're not in charge here. Look around. Take some time and go to another country and then come back and tell me how bad it is here. If you say that as a politician, you immediately violate the first issue. They would say, hey, you're still not listening. So what politicians did across the board in the Netherlands in 2002 is confirm people in their belief that this country was in shambles. And then now, talking to the same people again, I get the same answers. You're not listening. This country's in shambles. What has changed? First of all, people don't mind telling you about their vote. They were, in 2002, still a bit ashamed of having done this. It was sort of an obscene thing you're not proud of. No way. No way now. It is something people are proud of and not ashamed of in any case, and talk about this freely. No problem. Then if you look deeper into the issue, and I'll come to identity in a moment because that's where I want to elaborate upon. The most shocking experience I had, for me personally, was with the youngest generation. People who had voted for the first time, anyone between 18 and, let's say, 35. Their biggest motivation for their vote is simply to kick us in the face, to show a big, huge middle finger, to finger this country, finger the politicians, because they want to see what happens. Let's see what happens if we do this. Let's see if this will stir up things. Let's see if this will create a problem for all of them in The Hague. Why is this so unsettling? Because they see no relationship between their vote and what happens to them. Because they believe that whatever they do with their vote, their lives will not change. It will not influence them. It will just create a nice dynamic and all these fat necks and whatever you want to call them in The Hague will have a level of discomfort, and we'll see that on TV, and that's fun. And I insist on this point because I have spoken to many, many people like yourselves in the last couple of years. I love to do this. I put a lot of my private time into this. Why? Because one of the fascinating things about young people, your generation, is that there is so much idealism, unstructured, undirected, bottled up. And you as a generation, not you personally, have been put by us into this horrible comfort zone that you are never really challenged to see that what you have is not self-evident, to see that what you have is a result of a struggle or a result of a fight, result of hard work. So everything becomes play. And this is one of my biggest concerns and one of my biggest challenges to your generation. Get rid of us. Make your own structures. Do not think that when you're on the net, on Twitter, on Facebook, or whatever, that you're part of a functioning structure. That's Keanu Reeves's Matrix. It looks like it's the real world, but it's not. If you want to shape the world according to your beliefs, you need to get away from that computer, organize yourselves, fight the structures that have the power. They are so weak today that it takes not even a lot of effort for your generation to empower yourselves in a way that you will actually shape the future of this society. I might elaborate on this if there are questions about this. I'm very emotional about this because I'm talking about my own children, not just about you. And I don't understand that in this world that will change fundamentally, regardless whether you get out of your chairs or not, it will change. That you do not feel the unrelenting urge to shape this world according to your views, because it's out there to be shaped. If you don't do it, there are hundreds of millions of people in Asia and elsewhere who will. And they don't want to eat us or defeat us or whatever. But they have their own values, and they are not in sync on all issues with ours. And what we need is a dialogue with other parts of the world on the basis of our values, not to impose them on others, but to have a balance between different values. Nothing we hold as self-evident is self-evident and will be maintained if we do not get a move on. Right, now about identity. This is me preaching, finished. I want to talk to you about identity because it's such a topical issue. I tried to write a book about this because it's something that has been nagging at me for many, many years. Let me start by defining, in my view, the problem. Why do we have a problem when defining our identity? First of all, in this country, because we have no culture or history in defining our identity. You know, it's like asking a fish here in the water to define water. If you've never been out of the water, there is no way you know what water is. Only when you take the fish out, you say, hey, I want water. And this is what was going on in this country for many, many generations. We were stuck within our own identity. And what is called traditionally Dutch tolerance had nothing to do with tolerance. It was indifference. You don't bugger me and I won't bugger you. That was the attitude for generations in this country. And that is not the way a modern society can function. So that's the first challenge we have. The second challenge is, and this is something that is becoming increasingly a European problem, we are stuck in the present. We are prisoners of today. In this country, people have forgotten about our past. Education has a lot to do with this. I think generations have now been brought up in the belief that the world was created on the 10th of May 1940 when this country was invaded, and all the teachings of history have been linked with the Second World War, nothing else. So people lack context and are craving for a story that explains where they came from. There is also, by and large, and this is something I got out of many people also in my talks in the last couple of weeks, by and large, there is no zeal to shape the future. We want to stay where we are today because we are comfortable, and somewhere, intuitively, we feel that the world is changing and these changes are intrinsically negative. So the best thing we can do for ourselves is to keep what we have, to safeguard what we have, to keep changes at bay because they're for the worse anyway. And this is where identity comes into play a lot in the Netherlands. In my region, where people voted massively for an anti-Islam party, you would have a lot of trouble to even find a Muslim. You would have a lot of trouble to have a room with young people and then find somebody with a slightly darker skin or with a different complexion or a different origin. So the fear or the lack of openness towards diversity is not a result of diversity they experience, but is a result of the loss they fear. If they come here too, we will lose more than we've already lost. And in many Dutch communities, individualism, which is seen as a huge personal freedom, which is seen as a huge success, has also created a feeling of loss of community, which sometimes isn't even put into words, but is felt, and has led to a feeling of estrangement. And a politician comes along and says, there's going to be more estrangement because the Muslims will create their own kingdom here and force your daughters to wear a niqab and force you to go to the mosque on Sunday. People go, whoa. I've just been freed from going to the church on Sunday. Now somebody else is going to tell me to go to the mosque? No way. And what we have lacked to do, what we have failed to do completely in this society, many European societies, and here we can learn a lot from immigrant countries such as the United States and others, is to develop a concept of shared citizenship. Now, of course, football imagery comes into mind a lot now, but let me try and explain it using football terms, soccer terms, for those of you who prefer that. There's two ways you can be offside in a game. It's because you choose to be, and then you should, you know, get a decent kick in the butt and be told to abide by the rules, or because you don't know what offside is. And both things are present in Dutch society. And I think if you want a society to function as a team, people need to have the opportunity to know the rules of the game. If then they don't want to abide by the rules, you get them. Come on, let's talk about this. That's not right. You need to do this. And there's two mistakes in Dutch society we need to confront if we want to be successful. The first is to believe that in a diverse society like ours, these implicit rules are transmitted automatically from father or mother to son and daughter, like in the past. You don't need to make them explicit. This is something that happens at home. That's past generations. It doesn't happen anymore. You need to make these things explicit. And the second big mistake, in my view, is to believe, and this is something that is a big problem in Dutch society, to believe that integration and assimilation are the same thing. Because of our past. Now, if you want to know where the missing link is, if you starting from our past, when there was no debate about what identity was, and diversity was something for foreign countries and not something we had here, or we put it in its own box, interaction between communities was never a problem or never a necessity. You just gave them their own lives, their own football clubs, their own newspapers, their own insurance companies, their own trade unions, their own schools, their own shops. I can tell you that my grandparents lived near a bakery. And they asked me sometimes to go and buy some bread there when I was a very young child. At least I made a mistake. They asked me to go and buy bread. So I said, I'm going to that bakery which is next door. No. Sorry. You have to go to the bakery which is down the road. I said, well, that's a long walk. I don't want to go. That is a bakery. There's perfectly good bread here. They're Protestant. We don't, our business doesn't go to Protestants. We go to Catholics. We don't do that. That was Dutch society in 19, between still, this I'm talking about 1966 to 1967. So that's where we come from. We have never had intrinsic methods of accommodating these differences. And we had, and I want to finish on this, and perhaps we can then have a debate. We've had a great conference here in Amsterdam, not so long ago, organized by the University of Amsterdam and University of Applied Sciences, I think, Hogeschool, which is called, I think, in English, University of Applied Sciences. They got the boss or dean or whatever you call them of the DePaul University from the United States, which is the most diverse university in the United States. And he had this wonderful story about the difficulty of embracing diversity, that he had clashes all the time. The Palestinians would organize an exhibition and the Jews would be furious, and then he would ask the different communities to appoint someone to represent them and then get the representatives inside and talk to them and then make sure that there would be another exhibition which showed the other view, etc. And this was a complete eye-opener for the Dutch audience, because especially people who share my beliefs and perhaps your beliefs are too complacent about the difficulties for true diversity. We have been comfortable in our belief that this is something that will come naturally and it's the right thing to do, so we're all going to get along fine, etc. We have not developed the concept that if you want things to be good, it's always hard work. Now, I want to end on this because this is, again, one of my elements of my preach to the young. Never, ever shy away from hard work. There's this great speech by JFK. It's called the Moon Speech, back in 1962 or 63, not long before he was murdered, where he talks about the ambition of the United States to set a man on the moon. And one of the parts of that speech which is so inspiring is that he says, I know this is hard. We don't shy away from this because it's hard. We do it exactly because it's hard. Because it's great to do something that is hard. Because if you achieve something because it's hard, it's a bigger achievement than if you just do things that are easy. And if we can get this concept into our minds, that to create constructive diversity in a society is very, very hard work indeed. We can get going, we can make this happen, and we need to make this happen. Because if Europe, this country, does not embrace, fully embrace, the necessity of diversity, it will wither away and die and be a very, very interesting museum for people from Asia and America, but will not be master of its own destiny. And that's what we want for ourselves, to be masters of our own destiny. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We're going to open up for some questions. So does anyone have any questions or comments? Yeah.
Hi. Two questions. One is quite short. Do you see any hard work being done by young people that gives you hope? And the second question, you made the soccer comparison with the society as a team. You know the work of Willem Schinkel, he's a Dutch sociologist who is kind of wary about this comparison of society as a team, because when you become member, then this automatically means some kind of identity assimilation, which can kind of bite the diversity. What do you think about that?
Nonsense, short answer. No. On your first question, I see everywhere I meet young people, and also the young people who are not entirely not like you, but just people working day to day and doing, there is this incredible potential for good in them. There is this incredible energy waiting to be directed, waiting to be invested. But the problem is, and this goes back to your second question, the problem is that individualism, which is a huge achievement, has also created sometimes a lack of understanding that a community needs a number of agreed rules and agreed ways of behaving to be able to function as a community. If you travel to one of the most diverse cities on earth, which is New York City, immediately off the plane you get into a cab, and in the cab the rules of what the cabbie should do, what you as a passenger should do, etc., are made explicit, very explicit. And that's what I mean when no society can function without a certain level of implicit rules of behavior. If you don't do that, you cannot be a society. The problem in Dutch society today is that people talk, and also in all these talks I had, people always demand their rights and are always very keen in pointing out the duties of their neighbor. Because I can only benefit from my rights fully . Okay, so who set fire to this building? The issue is that if you believe that true freedom is maximizing your freedom, the only relationship you will have with the other is point out to them that when they want to exercise their freedom, they sort of impede your freedom of being exercised fully. And this is a very negative dynamic in Dutch society, you will see people being very angry because they got a ticket for speeding. Somebody's doing this on purpose. You will see somebody who's very angry because he got a ticket for speeding. He himself can determine which is the right speed to travel at. But the same person will be angry. Now, let me give you a much better example, very recent example. What are the two main sources of anger for Dutch people in cars? It was just analyzed nationwide. The first is people who drive in the left lane and should go back to the right lane. This is different in the United States. You can stick to your lane, not here. Yeah, if you want to overtake someone, you can only do this in the left lane, so people need to leave the left lane, and they don't. That's number one. You know what number two is? People who drive too closely to the people in front of them. Now, why do they drive too closely in the front of them? Because the people in front of them don't leave the left lane. So this is how you see that our mutual behavior is the cause of tension in society. You know, people don't even see that their behavior is the cause for the anger of the other and vice versa. And you can only solve that if you have a debate in education, at home, in society, about what citizenship is. And the problem with politics, to finish on this point, the problem with politics here, as elsewhere, is that we're into this consumer-producer relationship. Most voters, and I, you know, also most young people, they treat us politicians the same way as their cell phone service provider. You know, the damn thing doesn't work, give them a call, they should fix it. And they have the same expectations, by the way, of politicians as for their cell phone service providers. None. But there is a lack of understanding that citizens are not consumers. And if they do not understand that a society is built by citizens who take their own responsibility for things that regard them and their environment, you will never be able to sustainably build a society that needs to embrace change. And this is where we are today, unfortunately, in the Netherlands, that you do not feel, you source out all responsibility. I was on a television show, a lady called, she was angry at the Minister of Health. Why? Her son got to drinking and the minister didn't do anything about this. This is the level we've reached in the Netherlands. There's a complete lack of understanding that there's a concept of personal responsibility in these citizens' shoes. So you were not the next one. I think somebody right back there.
Hey, I'm Magnus. I was a fellow in 2008, and I did the Lancers Fellowship. And I had the fortune of being in the U.S. While Obama, he got elected. And one thing that struck me that was the hugest difference between U.S. and Europe is our representatives, both in Denmark and in the rest of Europe, they don't talk about visions. And in my eyes, they don't have any visions. And this is, I think this is very true, especially to the most important party, I think, in Europe. And that's the Labour Party or the Social Democrats. It doesn't matter if you're in Denmark or in Norway or Germany or Holland. They're the ones that have created our societies. But what are their visions? Where are they? I mean, in America, you talk about what you want to do in 10 years, in 20 years. But because we're so afraid of talking about, oh, we want the European Union to be strong, we don't feel like we can communicate that. I'm a young guy. I can understand the idea about Europe. I feel that I'm European, but my mother feels she's Danish. And I think that's the whole essence, because I need to connect those. So where are the visions?
Position, but I love to react to that. It's a very good point. It's a very good point. it goes back to being locked in the present. Because we want to keep people in their comfort zone, which is the present. And we talk about the future, they feel discomfort because the future is full of challenges and problems and not necessarily an improvement of the situation. And this is new to Europe. Since the Second World War until very recently, the idea of progress was innate in everything we did. Our children would be better off than us, and their children even better off. That's gone. It's not evident that this will happen. It needs to be fought for. It can happen, but it's not a necessity. And the second problem with Social Democrats, because you targeted Social Democrats quite rightly, and I need a few sentences to explain that. I'm sorry. What happened is that the real revolution happened in the 1980s, inspired by Thatcher and Reagan. And they had this vision, very clear vision, which had sense, which said that if you give people more private property, they will feel greater responsibility, and they will like to enhance their private property, but they will also want that to be in a community that is better off. And if you decrease government, you also decrease taxation, and you give people more personal income, and they will spend that, and again, the society will be better off. That is not an idiotic idea if you look at the societies the way they were in the 60s and 70s and the transformation that was necessary. Now, Labour, after that, sort of incorporated that idea, and it said, how can we use this new force that was generated by this to redirect funds towards general purpose issues? And actually, it was quite successful in the United States under Clinton and in the UK under Blair, and even here with Wim Kok. Much more was spent on health. Much more was spent on education using this model. But, as Tony Judd would say, the only thing we did is explain how and never tell people why. And that's the basis of the problem of social democracy today. We are in the position where we keep... When people tell us crime has gone up, we will give them a statistic which says crime has gone down, assuming that people are rational when thinking about feelings and politics. No, they're not. People are emotional. People have an idea, and you cannot convince people with statistics. And that's what social democrats do all over the world, try and convince people with statistics, and thus losing everywhere. But there's another issue which you mentioned as well. Social democracy has been complacent about traditional voters' worries about diversity, about loss of jobs, about things that are moving. People like you and me, the end of the day, if things go sour here, we pack our bags, and we'll go elsewhere, and we'll build a living. But the people my party was built upon have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to go. And they feel betrayed by intellectuals like you and me because we have it easy. They feel betrayed because we don't talk about their plant that goes to China or Romania or elsewhere. They feel betrayed because they don't know their next door neighbor. They don't understand what they're talking about. And we tell them all the time they shouldn't complain about this. That has been the mold within which social democracy has been operating in the last 20 years, 25 years. We're trying to get out of this, but we have a difficulty with this for one more reason, and I'll end on that. We are apologetic. The press that in principle would support us is apologetic. Are we right? We don't know. You tell us. Ruth. And you look at the right, especially the neocon right, it has an agenda. It is extremely focused. It is extremely personal. Look at what they're doing to President Obama, United States, and what they're doing to people in Europe as well. And they have a press which is scrupulous in supporting their agenda and supporting their goals. And the left used to be like that in the 70s or in the 60s when the left had an idea of how we change society. And the only solution for the left, if I can call it that, because these things don't mean the same thing as in the past, but But the only solution for progressive politics is, and I agree with you fully on this, to present an idea of the future we want. And yes, people will agree with you. Yes, people will disagree with you. But you will have an idea of your future you want. And then people might join you in shaping that future. People might join somebody else in shaping a different future. But then we're talking. And then we're moving again. And that's where we need to be. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Spencer Heinen. I did the Dutch program last year. Yeah. You talked about young people having a lot of idealism, in your view. You talked about Dutch young people in particular. I'm not sure if you extend that to young people across the board. My question is very simple, but at the same time, very hard to answer, obviously, like most questions that get posed here. How do you unlock that idealism? You mean this idealism is caged in? What is our role in unlocking this idealism? Obviously, we shouldn't tell them that they're wrong with statistics. We should present a vision. Is there more that can be done?
My dream is for us to learn to see the world as it is, and the developments, the tectonic changes the world is going through. I have an idea that sometimes things are changing so fundamentally that we choose to ignore it. And as far as I can see, we've not overcome this idea that we had a bipolar world and we have a unipolar world now. We are asking our planet to support 9 to 12 billion people. And if we continue living like this, it's impossible. We ask people in developing countries to join us at our level of welfare and our level of economic development. But if we don't change things, that will be impossible without war and without conflict. And this is a concept, and I could mention a lot of other things. If you, your generation, can develop this idea of global public goods, that the assets we have on Earth are the property of humanity, not of a nation or a number of nations, and that these assets are no longer limitless, but we need to talk about how we share them, and we need to go into a transition of how we create energy in a sustainable way. That is my dream for the youngest generation, that this becomes your agenda. Because the unique thing about this is, and that's why I'm optimistic, it is perhaps the biggest change humanity will go through in its history. At the same time, it is a possible change. The technology and principle is out there. It needs to be developed, but there's no unanswerable question. The people who can do this are out there. But they need to get organized. The nations and continents that can do this have the power, but they need to start moving. And that is where I think a younger generation can really create the dynamic we need. At the end of the day, you know, if you guys don't start kicking us in the butt, nothing will change. You need to get moving. You need to infiltrate all these political and other structures to show that you're quicker, that you're smarter, that you're willing to put your backs into it. And we are, as institutions in the Western world, we are so weak that with a little bit of effort, you can be masters of those institutions. I don't understand why you don't do this yet, but tomorrow perhaps. He was waiting for me.
All right.
My name is Roland Sprung. I'm here for the board of Poland. You had a great idea. As a European politician, you wanted to talk to
people who elected you or the other one. As you know, a lot of people, maybe not only in Europe, have the feeling that they are politikmüde. They don't feel represented by politicians. Therefore, I have the question, were there anything you learned from the people you talked to? Or is this only like, sorry to say this as a politician, once again, you preached what the people should do?
Well, I learn every day, and it's a humbling experience, I can tell you, because people aren't always nice to you. And if I knew everything and was just trying to preach, there would be no point in going to talk to all these people, because the political effect is zero. The only reason I do this is to understand. Is to understand. I'm not sure. I think politicians are extremely apologetic today, and in a sense, don't want to say to people, "Sorry, but I don't agree with you." Sorry, I don't agree with you. And in my experience, people respect you for saying what you think, also as a politician. And they can get angry at you when you say you don't agree with them. But if you go back to them and talk to them again and say again, "I don't agree, this is my point of view," you might not convince them, but they'll respect you for having a position, rather than just say, "Just tell me what you want to hear and I'll give you that answer." And I think because we are so locked into the present, winning politics today is about providing comfort within that present. So if you have an agenda which is about changing the world, and if you're honest as a politician, you say to people there are risks involved for you personally, for your community, etc., they will not today give you their vote. So the incentive is to sort of provide them comfort by saying that they're right and that things can stay as they are, and as long as we keep the foreigner out, things will stay as they are, etc. And we have done, especially in the Netherlands, we have done this so much in the last 10 years, and that's why we're so in the defensive. And the problem is that some parties haven't done this. But then you get this consumer-producer relationship. Social Democrats can't afford to do this. But if you're a left-wing liberal party or even a green party, you can afford to cater to one group. And that group will agree with you anyway, because they're not in that horrible place where they can't move when there's a problem. But your point, I want to end on that, is very, very valid. There is always a trap of just going through the motion of listening to people without actually acting on it, which is just as dangerous as listening to people and purely acting on their emotions or their impulses, which is also something politicians have done. And we haven't found in this society today the right balance between the two. And that is one of the reasons why people don't trust us anymore as politicians. There's another question here, I see.
Hi, my name is Natalie Gvalisch. I did the Denmark program in 2007. And I want to go back to a little bit rewind when you were talking about how we have to create our own vision and our own solutions. But at the same time, we have to sell it to the public. And I think it's so difficult because we are ingrained in a system in which we are living in a welfare state that is not sustainable. Because we are locking the rest of the world in a environment where they have to leave if they want to advance. And there will be more irregular migration. There will be also regular migration because we are taking the resources away, and we are subsidizing our own farmers to produce milk, at the price rather than buying it from the developing world, etc., etc. And really, to change the system, we would have to disrupt the comfort of Western citizens. And they are not, and that is not a vision that is sellable, because we believe that we have the right to live in a world where our children have education, our children have healthcare, our children have these services, and the rest of the world doesn't. And the migrants are seen as a problem because they are bringing down that system. And so how do you create... Yeah, no, absolutely not. How do you create solutions if maybe the problem is too systematic?
Well, the rotten answer to your question is very simple. If we don't do anything, things will change anyway, the hard way, because we won't shape them. The only thing, if we don't act, the only thing we can do is, over the next 20 years, simply scale down our social welfare states. That's what will happen. It's very easy. If you don't make them sustainable, if you don't get more people to actually work, if we don't get people to work longer hours, if we don't get people to get more skills, if we don't do all these things, the slow disintegration of the social welfare state will happen all by itself. Because every year there will be less tax coming in, less money to spend on these things, etc., etc. So in that sense, the deal is not to maintain things as they are and to go to a new situation. The deal is that you need to restructure fundamentally if you want to keep things as they are or even make them better. There's this, just a thought came to mind, there's this wonderful book called Il Gatto Pardo, which was written during revolutionary times in Italy. And a great film was made in 1963 by Luchino Visconti. Go and see that film if you don't want to read a book. And the main character in that book says, this is when everything is changing. The world is changing completely. They're becoming a republic. Sicily's losing its kingdom. Great history. But one of the sentences that I will never forget is the main character who wants to be a revolutionary saying, if we want things to stay as they are, things will have to change. And that is where we are in European and Western society. If we want things to stay as they are, things will have to change. And this is a proposition that could only be supported by the younger generation. We can make that analysis, and people will not like it. But if you can... I think your parents are willing to move if they know it's in the interest of their children. Sure they are. And that's where we need to be. That people understand that to reform our system, to fundamentally restructure our economy so that it's a sustainable economy, is something we need to do for the sake of our children. I'm not as gloomy as you are about the rest of the world. There are huge problems. People are starving in Africa and in other parts. There is a huge problem of distribution of food. There's a huge water issue that we need to solve. There's a huge commodities issue that will need to be solved. But don't forget that hundreds of millions of people fought their way out of poverty in the last 20 years. You see things happening in Asia that we would have never thought possible in the past. So these are developments that can help us transform in a way that could benefit our economy, benefit our social security systems, etc. I'm not that gloomy about this, but the fundamental point I need to make is that parents need to understand that if they want their children and grandchildren to have a good life, we need to get moving and change the system, and change our economy, and change the way we consume, and change the way we produce. And it's not all that difficult. It is all possible to do this. But we're not moving. And if we don't move, other people will move us within 10 to 15 years.
Hi, I'm Courtney Sender. I was just in the Denmark program. I have a question.
Outside of Denmark?
So you said that youth has to get off the computer, get off the internet, start changing the world the way that they want to. Do you not think there's a possibility that the internet is kind of the change that the youth in this world are seeing, and they're creating this new community that you're saying we should be creating via the internet and via this new these new channels with which to connect with the rest of the world?
It could be a start. I grant you that. But what I see many young people do is believe that this... They call themselves a network generation, and they're on the net all the time. I know. And the way you guys accumulate knowledge is incredible, and it will help us become smarter as a society. It's a wonderful thing. I admire it, and I'm addicted to it, so that's not my point. My point is that it creates also a virtual reality, as though that network and that structure will overtake by itself, without action, the existing power structure in the world. Now, that is not happening. That is not happening at all. So if you want that to happen, you will have to use it not as an end in itself, but as a tool to change the power structure that exists in the world. If you don't help us change this 1945 UN system, we will not create justice in the world. If you don't help us create a system which gets international finance under control, accidents will continue to happen. If you don't help us create a way in which commodities and the distribution of commodities is discussed in a peaceful way on the highest international level, we will have endless, endless fights and struggles over ever scarcer commodities in the next 30 years. This is what is at stake. This is an existential issue. You will not solve it simply by sitting behind your computer.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Deva. I am a Dutch intern. I was a French fellow last year. Your topic says the changing identity of Europe, and we're here to speak about the rights of minorities. So as a minority, I'm standing up, and I would like you to address the European other, because that's becoming increasingly an issue, and we're sort of circling around it here. Could you please give suggestions on how to address the fear of the one that feels European of the other, and the fear of the other that regardless of how well-educated, well-assimilated, well-integrated he or she is, and that's a personal question to you, he or she will never be the European. Could you please give concrete suggestions on how to address this tension that I felt in the Netherlands, that I felt in Paris, that I see as unemployment for minorities of Muslim, black backgrounds are facing in several European countries, and as they're slowly but surely socially becoming excluded.
Well, here again, it's an existential issue for Europe. If social exclusion becomes a norm, this society is going to wither away and die. I've no doubt about that whatsoever. And if you want me to jump to the solutions immediately, and I'll do that. I could talk. You know, the problem is, this is an issue that keeps me awake at night. I've written about it. I think about it all the time. It is also a very personal issue, given my own background. So I could talk about this for hours. But let me give you a number of ideas. I think we Europeans underestimate the necessity to put things into law. I think we should have more legal instruments to force companies, to force institutions to embrace a diverse society. This is something that was learnt through a long, long struggle in the United States. And I think this is an experience we can benefit from. We don't need to do the whole struggle again, but we can learn from what has worked in the United States. And this sometimes, in Dutch society, is very uncomfortable. We had a case at the highest court very recently where a political party was condemned for not granting women equal rights. And many people in the Netherlands were saying, oh, but they're so benign. Oh, they're quite cute, those Christians. Come on, let them have their own ideas about women not being allowed to be elected. And I think this is one of the biggest problems in Dutch society. If you are a diverse society, you have to become a far more legally based society as far as enforcing diversity. We need to embrace that. We need to say, okay, you might be a very nice Christian party with nice guys who do nice things, but in this country we will not accept that women are treated in a second-rate position. In this country, when somebody is not allowed to even come to an interview for an internship because his first name is Mohammed, we will not accept that, and we will punish the company who does this. There's too much the idea in the Netherlands that because these companies need these people anyway in the long run, the problem will solve itself. I think there is a necessity to be more American in these issues than we are today. That would be my first remark. My second remark is that we need to create, and this is also hard work, far more platforms where differences are debated and discussed. It's not happening today. There's an interesting, we've had, especially with what was going on in Gaza and elsewhere, we've had some horrible incidents of anti-Semitism in this city. Young people, especially young Moroccans, identifying completely with horrors that with their brothers, although they are not related to him, in Palestine, and saying that the Jews are to blame, and this then was taken to the street. Now, there's one very brave, very smart city councillor in this city. Her name is Fatima Elatik. And what she did, she created a platform for Muslims and Jews to talk about these things. And she created possibilities for young Moroccans to just go and see what Auschwitz is or Dachau. And those are initiatives we need to be far more forceful about. And this is not easy. This is confrontational. And people will be angry. People will not start by listening to each other. But these are very, very successful initiatives that we need to embrace more than we've done until today. And I strongly believe, that diversity will only succeed via struggle. So there is no people who want their position in society of any generation will have to fight for it. Fight for it. It took people with my background three generations. Three generations. And I had, for instance, a young guy working for me when I was a minister. One of the brightest persons I've worked with, he's abroad now. He had to color code the washing machine at home because his mother couldn't read the numbers on the machine. He had to color code her cell phone so that she knew how to call her son or daughter and etc. Within one generation, this guy was coming from an illiterate environment to a university degree to a high-level job in diplomacy. Within one generation. And we concentrate in this country all the time on crime statistics, etc., which is a problem which should be faced and confronted directly. And we neglect these enormous stories of success that need to be told. Thank you. Yeah. Guys, I need to travel all the way back to the south, which is, if you have the time ever, come and visit us. We're not that horrible. It's the most beautiful countryside you can find in the Netherlands. The best food you can find in the Netherlands, which is saying a lot. And come and see me if ever you want. Stay in touch. You can find me on Facebook. You can send me an email. If you want things, if you want to stay in touch, if you want to create a group, whatever, I'm at your disposal. I wish you a very good conference, and I really want to reiterate once more, get cracking and change the world the way you want it to be. Thank you very much.